The control and prevention of disease depends essentially on knowledge of its cause and appreciation of the manner of its spread. It is common knowledge today that whereas some diseases are due to the action of infectious agents, such as bacteria and viruses, others are due to dietary deficiencies. Scurvy at one time was widespread among civilians and soldiers alike. Yet it is not caused by any living infectious agent, but by lack of minute amounts of essential foods called vitamins. The foods in a normal balanced diet, when properly prepared, contain the needed requirement of these extremely important substances. It should not be necessary, therefore, when a good, balanced diet is maintained, to reinforce this with little pills. It has been known that vitamin A in adequate quantities is essential for proper functioning of the eye, particularly for vision under reduced light conditions. This knowledge is being applied with advantage by our Army. Night fighters, pilots, gunners are being supplied with large doses of vitamin A. One of the remarkable features of vitamin deficiency diseases is the promptness with which complete cure follows the intake of the needed vitamins. Nervous disorders, for example, brought on by lack of the vitamin B complex, rapidly disappear when the vitamin is supplied. With the dislocation of the food supply resulting from war, certain foods essential for vital activities may become scarce. Under these conditions, it may be necessary to resort to the use of vitamin concentrates. It is with the control of infectious disease that we wish to deal, however. As was already stated, the control of such diseases depends to a large extent on their mode of transmission, a factor greatly affected by the hardiness or survival capacity of the infectious agent outside the host. Fortunately, the survival time for most organisms is quite low. Some parasites, like the spirochete of syphilis, survive only for a very brief period, a matter of minutes outside the host. They are so vulnerable in respect to altered environmental conditions that they must usually be transmitted directly from person to person. Organisms such as the streptococcus or the bacillus of tuberculosis may be able to survive on dust particles in the air for a short time. Germs such as a typhoid bacillus may survive for days or weeks in water into which they have been inoculated. Such disease agents as the malarial parasite have taken up their abode in man on a part-time basis only and must be taken up by a mosquito to complete their development. Some of the larger parasites come to man only as a last resort when their normal host has been annihilated. Typhoid and other intestinal infections are no longer problems in this area. These diseases have been conquered. Yet in regions where sanitary principles are not rigorously applied, they may still produce widespread infection. To protect our soldiers against these diseases, vaccination is applied as a routine measure. Today, however, the sharp boundary between civilian and soldier during war has largely disappeared, especially due to the disruption of the civilian population by bombing. It may become necessary, therefore, to apply protective measures on a much wider scale than any heretofore used, and to instruct civilians more generally in the methods to be employed in freeing food and water from possible contamination. It is in the realm of airborne infection that the problem of controls becomes considerably more complex. I doubt whether there is a single individual who has not had at least one cold this winter, or one who has not passed it on to another. Staphylococci, pneumococci, and streptococci are around us all the time. Normal, healthy people carry these disease-producing forms, which, under certain conditions, may produce severe and often fatal infection in others. It is unlikely that the incidence of these airborne diseases will be greatly affected under our present way of life. But think in terms of the crowding and health hazards raised by underground, poorly ventilated bomb shelters. Indeed, here the problem looms so large that in England, some of her foremost scientists are at work on the subject. The results of one such finding states that no method for the control of infection is as effective as adequate spacing of individuals combined with adequate ventilation. Other methods are of value only as second-rate substitutes where proper spacing and ventilation cannot be achieved. What are some of these other methods? Physical barriers, such as the wearing of masks, may be helpful, but are not advocated as a general procedure. The use of ultraviolet light as a means of sterilizing the atmosphere has been found to be satisfactory in the experimental laboratory and in the hospital operating room. Yet field tests carried on in wards and elsewhere yielded results which were not too encouraging. The use of germ-killing sprays called aerosols was introduced a few years ago and produced moderately successful results. Treatment of floors, blankets, and clothes with substances which will cause the dust particles to adhere instead of being dispersed into the air may likewise aid in the prevention of airborne disease. It may well be, then, that the possible added protection to be gained from crowded, rapidly improvised, poorly ventilated bomb shelters against man-made weapons of death may merely make us more vulnerable to our less conspicuous enemies. Adherence to the ordinary rules of personal hygiene will aid in protecting against respiratory infections spread through the air. An uncovered cough or sneeze sprays myriads of droplets into the air. The smaller ones may be carried long distances. The Army, by ingeniously reversing the head and foot positions of adjoining cots, provides a maximum distance between the heads of adjacent men. Airborne organisms and others are found on the skin and surfaces of the body and often lead to the infection of wounds. To the civilian and soldier alike, the greatest godsend of recent times in the recovery from a variety of diseases, in the treatment of infected wounds and burns, has been sulfanilamide and its derivatives. Pneumonia, peritonitis, streptococcus, and other infections have responded miraculously to this treatment. If the spread of airborne infection often appears mysterious and its paths remain uncharted, the situation is markedly different in such infections as malaria and yellow fever. To most of the population of our city, insects are nothing but pests. They make us uncomfortable in the country. They even invade the privacy of our homes. But they are of infinitely more than nuisance value. The mosquito, the louse, and the flea together have no doubt been responsible for a larger number of deaths the world over than the total number yielded by the sword or gun, since these were invented by man. The most widespread disease in which insects are known to be implicated is malaria. As one author states, malaria is as commonplace as poverty and just about as persistent. It is found the world over, including our own country. We know that the elimination of the disease-carrying mosquito would eradicate the disease. We have known that fact for decades. And yet in India alone, during 1 year, and this in 1936, not in dark antiquity, 1.5 million deaths were attributed to malaria. The parasite producing the infection in man does not infect any other animal. Yellow fever of the epidemic type is spread, as far as we know, by a single species of mosquito whose habits and natural history are constant, so that adequate measures for its eradication can be taken. Malaria, on the other hand, is a much more difficult problem to control. It is spread by a variety of mosquitoes. Each species has its own peculiarities. Some breed in shallow, stagnant swamps and marshes. Others infest moving streams. Some can fly a long distance, and others cannot. All these factors must be considered, for the prime determinant in malarial control is the elimination of the mosquito, either by destroying its breeding places by adequate drainage, or by the destruction of its worm-like larval forms. Antimalarial measures are being widely applied in the southern United States, and the Army is aiding in this task. No discussion of insect-borne disease in war would be partially complete without reference to typhus fever. It has produced frightful epidemics in Europe. We in this country have our own native form of typhus fever, but here it is essentially a disease of rats. We need fear neither the European nor our own form, for both are controlled by simple measures which are being widely applied. The factor of prime importance in the control of this scourge is cleanliness. Under such conditions, lice do not thrive, and lice are required for the spread of the infection from sick to healthy people. The government is spending large sums in efforts to keep the rat population in check. Not only are rats important in the spread of our endemic type of typhus fever, but they are likewise concerned in the spread of a variety of other diseases. In Britain, the large-scale bombings have made the problem of rat control an important aspect of public health. Some diseases are transferred from one human being to another by direct contact, and in theory, at any rate, such infections should be easily controlled. The venereal diseases fall into this category. The incidence of these diseases in the last World War was high. We may expect, with the prominent role education has played since that time, that such incidence will be greatly reduced. We have attempted in this brief time to outline some of the general methods which are employed in the control of disease. Since World War I, we have made progress in numerous phases of the subject. More stringently applied preventive measures and the introduction of the sulfonamide drugs promise to reduce greatly the distress and loss of manpower resulting from disease. Past experience has shown that the exigencies of war stimulate the development of new techniques and new procedures in the control and treatment of disease. We cannot predict what startling discoveries may be made as a direct result of this war. It is unlikely that the civilian population of this country will be exposed to any new hazards from disease. In Europe, with its malnutrition and the disorganization of its people, the picture may be very different. The public health officials will do their share to keep our microbial enemies from these shores. We can aid in preventing the spread of infectious disease by keeping our resistance high and rigorously applying the simple measures of personal hygiene.